Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 20th of April. Our guest this hour is the author of A Rat Is a Pig, Is a Dog, Is a Boy, Wesley Smith, a senior fellow in human rights and bioethics at the Discovery Institute, is with us. He writes in the intro to the book that few issues generate such intense emotionalism or fervent support by their adherents as does animal rights. He says, I love animals. I wince when I see them in pain and moreover believe strongly that we as an enlightened people have a profound moral and ethical obligation to treat animals humanely and respectfully, by all means never to cause them to suffer for frivolous reasons, and strongly supports laws against cruelty to animals. But over the last 30 years, the concept of animal rights has seeped into the bone marrow of Western culture. The term denotes a belief system, an ideology, even a quasi-religion, which both implicitly and explicitly seeks to create a moral equivalence between the value of human lives and those of animals. The head of the animal rights organization, PETA, told Washingtonian Magazine, and thus the name of this book, A Rat Is a Pig, Is a Dog, Is a Boy, They Are All Mammals. The Supreme Court, thank you, Rhonda's just pulling in the wire for me, has also, you heard the story, struck down a free speech just moments ago, a federal law that makes it a crime to sell videos or photos of animals being illegally killed or tortured. We'll talk about that. This is an 8-1 ruling, the justices overturning the conviction of a Virginia man who sold dog fighting videos. So we didn't know that was going to be in the news within the last 2 minutes. Our guest just posted a blog about this as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm sure that we're going to have tons of them. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I should also tell you that Wesley is the author of Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, as well as Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World and Forced Exit, Euthanasia, Assisted Suicide, and the New Duty to Die. Wesley Smith, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, and good morning, Wisconsin.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Well, I didn't know this was going to happen 2 minutes before we talked to you.
Yeah, but I just read about it, too.
Yeah, so let's get your opinion on the Supreme Court striking down on free speech grounds this, making it a crime to sell videos of animals being illegally killed or tortured.
I actually just put a blog entry up at my blog, Secondhand Smoke, which is at the First Things blog, and I have not read the opinion. I'm a lawyer, so I want to be very careful here. But I'm dumbfounded that this would be considered free speech. I mean, why can't it be looked at in the same way obscenity is looked at? The activity itself violates the law. The depiction in the videos can only appeal to the prurient interests, and it violates community standards. Now, that may not be the standard in terms of this area of free speech law. I'm not an expert there. And as I said, I haven't read this opinion.
Right.
But I'm rather stunned from the depiction of the brief story I read about it, that the issue became, well, is this enough of abuse to or is this not enough of abuse to be protected speech? I don't see why depicting any abuse that is depicting illegal activity would be protected. I mean, what is being communicated?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll learn more about that as the day goes on.
But it
certainly
was an 8-1 decision.
Yes, it was.
And so that should give us a little pause in the sense that the usual, political or ideological divide
was not there.
Was not there, and the only dissenter was Scalia.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about what happened over the last 30 years so that animal rights has taken on a whole new meaning. It's changed considerably. Some of the groups have become quite violent. Why? Was there one person who started this movement or what?
Well, I think one person has started the movement. I don't think he quite intended to start it in the way it happened. But I think the first thing we have to distinguish is animal rights from animal welfare. Now, animal welfare, the idea of promoting the increased humane treatment of animals, better standards of animal husbandry and so forth, is a very worthy cause. It's a very noble cause. And, of course, as you mentioned, I support animal welfare, as you read from my introduction. But isn't it interesting that if you criticize animal rights, you have to assure people that you don't believe in torturing puppies? because that's how well the animal rights idea has sunk into the public consciousness. Most people think animal rights means being nicer to animals, and it doesn't. That's animal welfare. What animal rights is a belief in human-animal moral equivalency. It is a belief that rather than being human having the highest value of moral value, say, it holds that to suffer is what gives one rights. For example, Richard Ryder, who's an animal rights philosopher, calls it penience, and he says, quote, penience is the only convincing basis for attributing rights or indeed interests to others. Gary Francione, the law professor from Rutgers, who, by the way, cooperated with me in this book and is quoted thoroughly, even though he and I disagree, but I think I did justice to his belief system in context and his quotes. He says that what gives an animal rights is sentience, and that once an animal has sentience, which is a really low standard, it has the right not to be property. And so for all you Wisconsiners out there who have cows that are producing milk, that produce cheese, and so forth, the ultimate goal of animal rights is the eradication of all domesticated animals. It isn't to improve the treatment of animals. It is to end all human use of animals.
Dogs, cats?
Even dogs. In fact, now not all animal rights activists would be so candid, but Gary Francione, who, by the way, takes in dogs that are not otherwise adoptable, had told me, he said, we consider them to be refugees in a world in which they do not really belong. He wants no dogs.
Oh, my. Let's start with medical research. There have been acts of violence against doctors who have performed this. Houses have been burned. People have been threatened. Tell me how the extent of this kind of reaction against medical research and the impact it's had on medical research.
Right, and you also have minks, you know, released to starve in the wild, and you've had the food industries attacked and so forth. When you believe thoroughly, as the animal rights movement does, that what you do to an animal should be viewed in the same way as if the same thing were done to a human being, and again, we're distinguishing animal rights from animal welfare, then some people who are the less hinged might go further than advocacy and certainly further than Gary Francione, who promotes veganism and, by the way, abhors violence. And you begin to attack those that you perceive to be engaging in evil. And so if a rat is a pig, is a dog, is a boy, and as Ingrid Newkirk said, and you have these scientists doing experiments on monkeys to try to figure out how to restore vision to the people who've lost their sight. You have people doing using lab rats to find a cure for cancer. Some of the very unhinged get violent. In the UK, it got so bad, and this was an awful story. There was a farm family that raised guinea pigs, and they raised them humanely for use to sell to labs for use in medical research. And the animal rights activists there got so unhinged, after years of threats, intimidation, not only against the farm family but the village itself, threats of violence, threats of killing and so forth, they robbed the grave of the grandmother of the farm family and said, we will not give her body back until you stop raising guinea pigs. And
oh my.
That finally pushed the farm family out of the business. This is an issue in which reason and rationality often loses to the rant, and the hyper-emotionality of many who support animal rights, and again, as opposed to animal welfare, can lead people into very nasty nasty behaviors.
Yes. So what impact has it had on medical research? Are labs not using monkeys as much anymore? Well, have they cut back on the animals they use?
You find tremendous costs for security. Some of the labs are put underground. Cambridge University, I think it was, it might have been Oxford, but I'm pretty sure it's Cambridge, actually canceled a lab facilities that would have used primates, monkeys, for necessary experiments because of the threats. You have very good people driven out of the business, out of the work. There was a UCLA researcher who was using monkeys to try, as I said, to try to restore a vision to the sightless. And the way the experiment involved implanting electrodes in the brain and then attaching that to a small optical camera, and the hope was that you could stimulate the optic nerve. He had people pounding on the walls of his children's bedroom. And he finally said, I've had it, and he left. And who knows whether that research would have would have borne fruit. We have other monkey experiments, for example, that now are allowing people with disabilities to use robotic arms with their minds to actually move items and control their environment. That would not have been possible without experiments on monkeys. So the question becomes, would the animal rights activists prefer that people with disabilities not have that capacity, not have that ability to increase their independent living, or that we use monkeys in this instrumental way, but do so in a way that reduces their suffering? And the animal rights activists say the monkeys count as much as the people with disabilities, and therefore we can't use them. It's as if you were using a human being in that experiment involuntarily, and I say the contrary, and that's what the fight's all about.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about this issue of suffering. Some would say that when we look at animal welfare, we have to look at animal suffering as well. And as a use, and when we look at medical research, animals may suffer, and please define that term, because of research. And we shouldn't allow that. We should just figure out some other way to come up with a robotic arm or to...
Well, there's no other way to do the testing, because at some point you have to try some of these things in a living organism. I certainly support the three R's, and that is worked at very hard in life sciences: refinement, reduction, replacement. That is the attempt to reduce the number of animals used in research. But there comes a point, and it, by the way, it's a human rights protection. There comes a point when you have to try something in a living organism. Eventually, cell lines don't do the job. Computer models don't do the job. You have to try it in a living being, and that is either going to be an animal at first or a human. And by the way, animals are part of an integrated... I spend a couple, three chapters in Rat as a Pig, as a Dog, as a Boy, describing how this works, because it isn't, oh, let's get the animals and cause them to suffer. They are actually... A small but essential part of the overall method of scientific research. The Nuremberg Code, for example, requires animal testing on these, for example, medical drugs or various other medical products on animals before human beings. And that saves lives, because sometimes these things cause great difficulty. For example, there was a protease inhibitor for AIDS tried on animals that was thought to work, and it destroyed the animal's liver. So the company went back to the drawing board, did a new formula, came out. That did not destroy the animal's liver. It eventually then was tested in humans and is now in the marketplace, saving lives, countless lives, helping people live with AIDS, a quality and healthy life. If that hadn't been tried in the animals first, it would have been tried in people. People would have died, and that whole area of scientific research probably would have been foreclosed. You must use animals in research if it's going to advance. Now, we can say the potential suffering to the animals isn't worth the advances. That is, Gary Francione, again, for example, will make that argument that regardless of the benefit to humans, it's unethical to do this research. But it is not, it seems to me, intellectually honest to say that animal research doesn't benefit humans, because it clearly does.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this issue of human exceptionalism. You write about the fact that it seems to me whether we will knock human beings off the pedestal of moral distinctiveness or move forward to create a better world for people and animals alike from the position of human moral responsibility. This goal requires not the relinquishing of human exceptionalism, but rather its wholehearted embrace.
Yeah, I feel very strongly about that. It seems to me that actually one of the great moral questions of the 21st century is whether human life will still be considered to have exceptional value simply and merely because it's human. That, to me, is a fundamental insight that undergirds universal human rights, for example. If being human isn't what matters, how do you support universal human rights? Because if you say that being human is morally irrelevant, ethically irrelevant, then you have to find some other standard by which to judge the value of life. In animal rights, as we've discussed, it might be if an animal can feel pain or an individual can feel pain, that gives rights. So in this view, since a cow can feel pain and a human can feel pain, raising dairy cows is morally equivalent to human slavery. Well, that's an odious comparison, and animal rights activists make that all the time. That is, comparing the worst evils against human beings with normal patterns of animal husbandry. And that diminishes the value of human beings, because it also diminishes the true evil of slavery. To say that dairy farming is like human slavery that we had in this country for hundreds of years is to diminish the true evil that was the American slave system. The other thing is, another approach is in bioethics, which is a little beyond our scope here. Bioethics, Peter Singer, who's kind of got one foot in this animal liberation issue and one foot in bioethics, he says that, and doesn't believe in animal rights because he doesn't believe in rights per se. He's a utilitarian philosopher. And he says that what gives value isn't being human. It is the ability to be a, quote, person. That is, to have sufficient cognitive capacities that, for example, being self-aware over time. That's what he says gives value. Well, if that's true, and he believes this, there is such a thing as a human non-person. And that would include embryos and fetuses, which many might agree with and some wouldn't agree with. But it also includes, for Peter Singer, newborn infants, because a newborn infant isn't self-aware over time, isn't able to value his or her own life. It would also preclude people like with late-stage Alzheimer's, who are considered to have lost that moral status. And so you actually see in bioethics, and this is perhaps subject for a different show, because there's a lot here, advocacy for using people diagnosed in a persistent vegetative state as organ donors or in medical experimentation precisely because they've lost that subjective attribute of personhood. And that's why if you don't have human exceptionalism, the weak and the vulnerable among human beings will be, I believe, victimized.
And there's another whole book and talk show,
Culture of Several Death, the Assault on Medical Ethics in America. That's what that book's about.
That's what I was thinking maybe was the case. Let's look at another issue that really gets people concerned, and I would bet that there is a substantial portion of this audience that wouldn't think of wearing fur because of criticism, because I think a lot of people now believe that raising animals, and they have a belief that those animals are harmed in some way by this process just for the human benefit of being warm, is not a good thing.
Oh yeah, fur is the proverbial, if you'll pardon the pun, red flag in front of the bull. The book is, by the way, is not about defending particular animal industries. That's
right.
That's not my purpose.
No.
Although I do defend very strongly medical research with animals. I do present both sides of the fur issue, though. There are a lot of lies presented by, for example, people of the ethical treatment of animals about the current method of fur trapping, as one example. PETA, on its website, says that these fur trappers, and they tell this to children, which is lying to children, that the trappers still use those old-fashioned toothed, jagged-edged steel traps that would break the animal's legs. That's not true. The kind of trap that is used to catch wild fur animals is the same kind of trap that caught the wolves that were eventually moved to Yellowstone from Canada. The trap itself, cause injury to the animal. Obviously, when the animal is dispatched, the animal has been killed, but the trap itself is not that same kind of cruelty that PETA likes to depict. In fact, let's talk about some of the attributes of PETA. PETA is a very subversive organization. They're brilliant propagandists. But listen to this. This is about a comic book that PETA gives to children, and it's called Your Mommy Kills Animals. And on the cover, it depicts a woman in a Leave It to Beaver kind of dress, the old 50s where the mother, mommy, had pearl necklace on and a dress and an apron, right? And she's stabbing this rabbit with a butcher knife, and the rabbit looks like Thumper out of Bambi and is looking out for help at the reader who's looking in, breaking the fourth wall. And here's the text on the inside. Tell mommy that she paid men to hurt and kill animals. Ooh. Everybody knows. And the sooner she stops wearing fur, the sooner the animals will be safe. Until then, keep your doggy or kitty friends away from mommy.
Ooh.
She's an animal killer. And with regard to, they have one, daddy kills animals, and he's a fisherman. And this is how this one ends. Until your daddy learns that it's not fun to kill, keep your doggies and kitties away from him. He's so hooked on killing defenseless animals, they could be next. Can you imagine if your 6-year-old, 7-year-old kid came home crying and saying, don't kill kitty, mommy? But the fervor of animal rights belief includes these kind of comic books which could interfere with the proper parental-child relationship.
And what's the campaign, I can't remember who was conducting it, that you write about to not drink milk?
Well, PETA and others do not drink milk, but PETA's real campaign in that regard was Holocaust on Your Plate. And again, that gets us back to the idea of depicting the worst human evils as the same thing as animal husbandry. Holocaust on Your Plate ran for 2 years on college campuses, at rock concerts all around the world, a lot of money behind it. And it would show very odious depictions and juxtapositions of photographs of the concentration camp evil with animals. For example, there was a picture of that famous picture of the inmates at Auschwitz in the stacked bunks, crammed in the stacked wooden bunks, next to a picture of chickens in cages. And the most odious one was a collection of dead Jewish inmates after the camps were freed. But you had dead, emaciated inmates on the ground next to a stack of dead pigs. That's odious on several levels, considering these were Jewish victims. And here's the text, part of the text anyway. Like the Jews murdered in concentration camps, animals are terrorized when they are housed in huge, filthy warehouses and rounded up for shipment to slaughter. The leather sofa and handbag are the moral equivalent of the lampshades made from the skins of people killed in the death camps.
Oh, my goodness.
Quote, you know, I've been to Auschwitz. I've been to Birkenau. I've stood in the gas chamber. I've seen the crematoria. I've walked that horrible rail terminus where Jews were separated out for immediate slaughter or torture in the forced labor camp. And it strikes me that anybody who would make a comparison between animal husbandry and the worst evil of humankind has no business preaching morality to anybody.
We're going to go to phone calls. Something tells me we're going to have more than a few for you. Our number is 800-486-8655. Wesley Smith is our guest. His latest book is A Rat is a Pig, is a Dog, is a Boy, The Human Cost of the Animal Rights Movement. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, Anna Quinlan will be with us. Anna is a wonderful writer. She has a new novel. She's written a number of works of fiction and nonfiction and wrote for the New York Times for a number of years and also for Newsweek magazine. She's now opened the door for other people to enter the profession, younger people to enter the profession, even though she's not very old. She's a delightful guest, and she'll be with us tomorrow. All right, let's go to phone calls. We start our calls with Sheila from Adams County. Hi, Sheila.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm wonderful today.
Good.
I happen to wholeheartedly agree with your guest and the positions that he's taking. And one of the things that I wanted to point out, and I'm sure your guest will do this as well, is that the Humane Society of the United States is very much linked with PETA's philosophy, and they have similar beliefs. The concern that I have with that particular organization is they tend to do people who love their pets, their dogs and cats, and they have wanting to assist and abandon their sheltered animals, contribute vast sums of money to this organization. And the organization provides less than 1% of their budget to shelter animals, while your local humane society suffers and tries to care for these poor little creatures. And the Humane Society of the United States, their director has made it very clear that it's their goal to eradicate pet ownership in the country. They don't want anybody to be able to own their dog or their cat for any purpose, including service animals.
Yeah, I'm a little confused. This is a different Humane Society than the Humane Society we go to walk dogs and adopt dogs from?
Exactly.
Yes.
They have a very similar name, so it confuses people, but it's called the Humane Society of the United States. It's called HSUS, and I'm sure your guest knows quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And
HSUS, I call it a stealth animal rights organization because it, unlike PETA, HSUS isn't out there pitching the animal rights dogma. It talks about itself as promoting animal protection, but it's really dedicated, and it has over $200 million. To lobbying, bringing litigation, and so forth. Sometimes HSUS exposes true abuse, and when that happens, that should be dealt with. But it also put pregnant pigs in the Florida Constitution to prevent them from being used in gestation crates. Florida is not exactly the pig state. There were only two herds in the entire state, and yet more than $1 million was put into Florida on that initiative. And the reason is there is an attempt to blur the distinction between humans and animals. Wayne Passau, who's the head of HSUS, before he joined HSUS, he's very professional. He's always in a suit. But he basically said, I haven't heard him say he doesn't want dogs or cats, but he said with regard to, and they were a form of domesticated cattle, I think, he said, one generation and out, we have no problem with the extinction of domestic animals. They are the products of human selective breeding. Wayne Pacell is a vegan. That's always a good sign that somebody's probably into animal rights. He has made HSUS full vegan. HSUS opposed the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which sought to prevent the kind of violence against not only animal using industries, but also their insurance companies and their bankers. It's a tactic called tertiary targeting, where you terrorize the bank of an animal using industry so that the bank will no longer give that industry an account. And that is an attempt to drive out of business, particularly some Huntington Life Sciences, which is under this kind of assault. And the attempt to prevent that was opposed by HSUS. HSUS, I just found out, funds PETA to some degree. It strikes me that they are animal rights, although they don't pitch the dogma. They do not have pet shelters. The local Humane Society that spays and neuters dogs and shelters dogs are not connected with the Humane Society of the United States. And the Humane Society of the United States, as Sheila said, gives very little of their assets to these pet shelters. That's not what they're in it for. There is actually something called Humane Watch, which is a blog. I believe it's funded by the food industry. I'm not sure, so people should be aware of that part. But if they go to Humane Watch, you'll see some stories about HSUS. In my book, I tell the story of how it's trying to shut down a foie gras farm in New York. And one of the things it did was sue the foie gras farm for water pollution, which was eventually thrown out of court. But what was so ironic is that when the state of New York tried to give the farm a grant to help improve its water pollution practices, it sued to prevent it from receiving the grant. So it was working at cross purposes against itself environmentally, but the purpose wasn't environmental. The purpose was to shut down the farm.
And where do they get all their money?
They get grants and so forth, but as most of your listeners may have seen these ubiquitous ads of Wayne Pacell petting dogs and dogs being put, abused dogs being put in shelters, they pitch their wares in an strongly implied way that they're protecting dogs and cats in shelters when they're not. They get a lot of money. And PETA gets millions of dollars. And a lot of this comes from people like Bob Barker, who just gave PETA $2.5 million to build a building in Hollywood from which they can do their business. Paul McCartney, here's a really classic. Paul McCartney, when his wife Linda died, it's important to remember, Linda was an avid horsewoman. So when she died of breast cancer, Paul McCartney gave breast cancer research millions of dollars. Good for him. He then turned around and gave PETA millions of dollars, which was working at cross purposes with his first donation. And he seemed to be unaware that PETA thinks that Linda was an animal abuser because she rode horses.
Oh, my. And it was working at cross purposes because
PETA seeks to impede medical research with animals
that would affect breast cancer research,
cancer treatment and cures.
Okay, thanks, Sheila. Zach from Green Bay. Hi.
Thank you. As a meat eater, may I say that my comments have to do with animal welfare and not animal rights. But I do assert that today in the United States there is more abuse of animals going on than ever before because of the large scale. Modern food production system that we have. We have less oversight and more self-regulation of this industry than we've had in decades. The emphasis is on speed, efficiency, and the viewing of animals solely as a commodity. Today we cannot legally view how chickens in the largest production facilities are raised. We can't film it, photograph it, or anything, and we cannot view, photograph, or film how animals are slaughtered. My final point is capitalism is supposed to be driven by the invisible hand of the market. which has the underlying assumption that consumers have knowledge of their choices. And today, in the food production industry, producers are successfully able to limit and deny knowledge of consumers.
I don't disagree with the caller. The idea of the so-called factory farm, I think, does deserve further study. I don't tend to believe with the animal rights depictions because they engage in hyper hysteria, I believe. But on the other hand, I found a difficult, and in fact I didn't get to, go to one of these facilities. So I do think that this is an important animal welfare issue. I do think we have to understand that industrial methods keep the price of meat reasonable, and it strikes me that when very wealthy people say that single mothers with three children should have to pay $2 extra per pound for a pork chop or for some other form of meat, I think it's very easy for them to say. When I went to my local grocery store to buy eggs, I always buy free-range eggs, but they cost $4.50 to $5 a dozen, where an unlabeled carton of eggs a dozen can be obtained for $2. Now, I find it very hard for me to say that a person with less means than I have should have to pay three extra bucks per dozen of eggs. On the other hand, if animals are being abused, and there are also safety issues, for example, antibiotic use, environmental issues that I don't get into, that is also necessary to be looked at. I'm a strong believer in labeling. When I wrote a book with Ralph Nader called No Contest, we took corporate lawyers in the perversion of justice in America, we took on Monsanto because they were trying to prevent milk suppliers from labeling their milk as being free from bovine growth hormone. And they tried to prevent that kind of labeling so consumers could buy milk that didn't have come from cows that had this hormone given to them. I believe in labeling on this issue also, and there is such a thing as humane meat. Humane meat, which is, we might say, raised on an old McDonald's kind of farm, and therefore has a more natural existence. It does cost more. And so these are some of the animal welfare issues that need to be weighed and balanced. But I would like to see more regulation over industrial farming, because I do think that's an important animal welfare issue.
Yes. I know you mentioned Temple Grandin in your book.
Yes, and I admire her tremendously.
Yeah.
Temple Grandin, for your listeners who might not know, is a woman from, and she's in Utah. She has a mild autism, and she believes that that gives her the capacity, because she sees the world so visually, to perceive the world the way animals might perceive it. And it has helped her create methods, for example, of husbanding cattle, including to the point of slaughter, that has done tremendously to do away with distress and fear. And so when the animals are finally slaughtered, they're not even aware it's coming. She's done great work. And animal rights activists loathe her in many cases because she is making eating steak more palatable to people because they think it's more ethical. Remember, animal rights activists don't want to have any steak at all.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Zach, for your call. Matt is next from Madison. Hi, Matt.
Kathleen, you have to have Wesley back again soon. Anyhow, here, I have a quick philosophy. I'm a hunter, fisherman. I garden. I have dogs and cats. I do not believe that people are more important than animals. And I'm going to go this way with this. It might not be the most popular view, but what happens in nature, the strongest survive. In wild nature, the strongest animals survive. Now, we take animals and we use them to benefit us. And I was curious to know Wesley's view on, is this a hindrance to the normal nature and progression and evolution of humankind?
And I think very interesting. I do think human beings have greater value than animals, which is, of course, not to say that animals have no value. You know, human beings, I think, are getting a bad rap. There's an awful lot of anti-humanism out there. But we are the only species that actually sets out to mitigate suffering on the planet. And just one quick example. I live in California. Once in a while, injured seals wash ashore on the beach. Now, any other species that saw an injured seal, defenseless seal on the beach would either eat that seal or ignore that seal. We rescue that seal. And that does interfere with natural selection, which I have no problem with. I think our compassion, our altruism, our empathy is one of the strongest attributes of and important differences in being human. And so I have no problem with not living in a purely materialistic, Darwinistic world. That leads to social Darwinism, and we've seen in history that leads to eugenics. We've seen in history where just allowing purely neo-Darwinistic impulses to control our human society can lead to very, very bad oppression of the weak and the vulnerable.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to a couple emails, Wesley. Thank you for this topic. I support animal welfare and always adopt pets from the Humane Society. I've run into criticism when I state my belief that there's a limit to the cost of care. When a vet bill totals more than $200 to $250, I don't believe that it is money well spent when so many people suffer from lack of food or medical care. What's your opinion on this, Wesley?
I don't think I would. I think people have a right to use whatever money they have to take care of their own animals. But I think that raises an interesting issue, which also gets into the assisted suicide issue that I often, I oppose assisted suicide and work with that. I'm often told in that regard, well, we euthanize cats and dogs. But we do that often, not because there's no other way to take care of these animals to relieve their suffering, but because of the cost of that, or because the animal is incontinent. But are we going to euthanize grandma because she's incontinent? Even stray animals, you can get to the issue, well, does that mean we should euthanize the homeless? Of course not. The emailer is right. There is a moral distinction between human life and how we treat that human life, how we care for that sick and disabled human life, versus an animal life. And I think that most people, you hit a squirrel in the street, we call, oh, shoot, but it's roadkill. If you hit a child in the street, it's a completely different thing. Most people understand that instinctively. The problem with animal rights, when it really sinks into the bone marrow and the belief system, is that they can't see the distinction between the squirrel and the child.
Mm. Really? It's reached that level.
For the true believer, yes. Huh.
Ann is next from Madison. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Well, first of all, I am a vegetarian. I'm not quite a vegan. I would like to be. I had 2 points. One is that I'd like to know whether your guest thinks that the kind of cruelty that comes from cooping research animals up in cages, like, apes. I mean, who in their natural habitat, which human beings have destroyed, would have huge amounts of land and a whole bunch of variety to exist in, whether that's a kind of cruelty that we as creatures who believe ourselves mentally superior to all other species have a right to inflict on them. But even more important, as for experimenting with animals to cure human diseases, to prove that shampoo won't sting your eyes. I think that's just absolutely an outrage. But so often these experiments with non-human species proved to be invalid in predicting cure or even improvement of human diseases and maladies. So if they're useless, and if working with animals under these horrendous conditions kind of makes sadists of a lot of people, they often come to realize just how pointless these very, very profitable experiments are. Why should we do it?
Well, there was misinformation in that question. For example, that humans don't benefit from animal research. This is a half truth that is pitched by animal rights activists. They will say, "Well, look, you've had this drug tested on animals. It went into people, and it had to be recalled because of side effects that caused harm." But hey, you have to understand that the drug testing on the animals doesn't go, oh, it worked on lab rats, let's put it in your doctor's office. That's not what happens. If it appears to be efficacious and safe in the animals, then it goes into several years of human subject trials, which deal with efficacy, safety, and so forth, and only then does it go into the medical clinic for use generally. And even then, sometimes it turns out that the unforeseen problems occur and these drugs have to be withdrawn. But if you didn't do the animal testing originally, like I discussed earlier on the protease inhibitor situation, you would have human subjects dying and being harmed rather than lab rats or other animals. And I would prefer to have the animals be put at risk first rather than people. In terms of the ape issue, there's very little testing that is done on apes, certainly not on gorillas and so forth. Chimpanzees, that's a very important issue because chimpanzees have high intelligence, they're social animals, and there are very few things that are done on chimpanzees, and I think that's appropriate that there be very few things done on chimpanzees. But chimpanzees get HIV-1 and don't get sick from it most of the time. And scientists think they're necessary for research to try to find a cure or a vaccine for AIDS. There are a few other experiments I describe in the book in which chimps are used. Chimps were essential for the creation of the hepatitis vaccine. And Peter Singer was asked, well, should we have used chimps? He said it would have been better to use cognitively disabled humans. I disagree. I think in very rare circumstances with very important benefit, we can properly use these animals in research. But generally speaking, I support the idea that we don't use chimps. I think that the proper use of animals, it depends on the kind of animal they are, the kind of suffering that they are capable of. And by the way, there are plenty of laws that protect animals in these lab conditions, and there are also voluntary associations that most credible labs join that create very stringent standards of preventing suffering. In fact, pain is to be prevented in these animals unless pain is actually being studied. And then even then, as soon as that pain can be stopped, it should be.
What do you mean it depends on the kind of animal it is?
For example, I think the way you treat a lab rat is should be different than what you do to a chimpanzee, because the chimpanzee probably has greater capacities to experience not only pain but perhaps fear and suffering. So, you know, we have different animals react differently in different circumstances. I mean, I think that what we do to an animal shouldn't be the same to all animals. I mean, I do think there should be a higher standard of care for a chimp than for a lab rat.
We're welcoming more phone calls in just a moment. Thanks, Anne, for your call. Our guest is the author of A Rat is a Pig is a Boy is a Dog, The Human Cost of the Animal Rights Movement. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. For the first time all hour, there are two lines available, so take them in. We have a ton of emails. We'll try to get to as many of those as possible. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wesley Smith, author of A Rat is a Pig is a Dog is a Boy, is our guest, The Human Cost of the Animal Rights Movement. 800-486-8655 is the number. Bill from Brown Deer is next. Hello, Bill.
Hi. Just 2 points. First of all, don't these PETA people wear shoes? Leather is fur with the fur taken off the skin, the hide. That's 1 point. The second point is, the reason we have mass food production farms is because the population is swelling. How else are we going to feed people? That's it. That's all I got.
All right. Thank you. That's all he's got, Wesley.
That's all I got. Those are two good points. First, if one is an animal rights activist, one, and I think Gary Francione is right here, you have to be a vegan. That means you not only do not eat meat, you do not wear leather shoes, you do not have a leather belt, you do not use any product that has animal in it altogether, although it's almost impossible. For example, anybody who goes and receives any medical treatment developed in the last 50 years, an animal was used, and many animals, in the development of that, whether it's a drug or a new surgical technique or scanning techniques, whether it's modern pain control. For example, in the book I describe Ingrid Newkirk, the head of the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, broke her wrist, and she used that as an article in an animal rights magazine saying, thank goodness for the pain control, but how horrible it must be for a monkey who breaks their wrist in a cage and doesn't get pain control. Well, that's wrong, because if a monkey breaks its wrist, the lab would take care of that. But where does she think the pain control came from? It just developed out of nowhere. That pain control that she got so much benefit out of required the use of animals to develop in its delivery and the modern methods of techniques. So that it is impossible by the way, to not involve yourself in the use of animals. Even vegans, when you think about it, I mean, vegans will say, meat is murder, but we're cruelty-free. That's not true. Millions and millions of animals are killed every year in plant agriculture. When the combines mow the wheat fields, they're killing countless mice and snakes, and in a very cruel way. And you bring this up to them, and they'll say, "What you say? Well, you did not. Your vegan diet doesn't come without killing animals." Their heads explode. But it's the truth. You poison rats and mice in the silos, and they die a very painful death from that poison. There is no way anybody in your audience is alive today without an animal having died to help promote that life.
Ooh, there's a statement.
Either by plant or by animal.
Oh, my gosh. All right, here's somebody who wants to take you on. Bonnie from Madison. The PETA quote is usually taken out of context. She says, the complete quote, when it comes to pain, love, joy, loneliness, and fear, a rat is a pig, is a dog, is a boy. Each one values his or her life and fights the knife. I've looked at PETA's publications and didn't see the ones you mentioned. I suggest people look at PETA's website. The painful steel draw leg hold trap has yet to be banned. It does cause pain, and some animals will chew their legs off trying to escape.
That's just not true. It's just not true. What you have, the PETA depicts the old fashioned jaw, jagged jawed metal trap that is not used anymore. The kind that is used is the same kind, as I said, that captured the wolves in Canada that were then moved to Yellowstone. Those wolves were not injured in that process because the trap doesn't injure. Ingrid Newkirk has used the a rat as a pig, as a dog, as a boy, quote, in several ways, and sometimes tried to mitigate the what she is saying, which is that there's a moral equivalence among all animals, including humans. Here's the quote I took. It's from Vogue. She gave in 1989, if your listener wants to look it up, quote, animal liberationists do not separate out the human animal, so there is no rational basis for saying that a human being has special rights. A rat is a pig, a dog is a boy. They are all mammals. That's the quote I used, and that is very clear that she's saying that there's a moral equivalency between humans and animals. And you cannot get Ingrid Newkirk to say that raising chickens is less evil than the Holocaust. Several have tried to do that. And she will not say it because she does not believe it. And PETA believes in the Holocaust on your plate. They believe, in fact, Ingrid Newkirk is so anti-human, she has said that she wishes human beings had never appeared on the planet. So there's a lot of misanthropy in this movement.
Daniel from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go right ahead.
Right off the bat, I wanted to say I am an omnivore. I do eat meat. I am not an animal activist. But I did want to ask your guest if he was aware of a couple of recent experiments, studies that have just been published showing that rats have been demonstrated to be capable of altruistic behavior and tendencies. Two rats placed in a cage adjacent to one another learn that when they press a lever, they receive nothing, but the rat in the next cage does receive a reward, food. Then they learn to reciprocate this, creating a tendency towards altruistic behavior that paralleled the study that showed that humans are basically the same way. A human.
I'm aware of some of those experiments, and what moral value does that what does that do? Do you think morally to this discussion?
A couple minutes previously, you said that you believe that there should be different standards for different animals in their treatment and experimentation. If altruistic tendencies are demonstrated in creatures all the way from rodents to primates, then upon what basis should we differentiate them and give some more protection than others?
All right, good idea. Good question.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that, you know, first off, these altruistic tendencies are pretty implied. But beyond that, we're not talking about altruistic tendencies. We're talking about what capacity do these animals have to experience pain. What kind of fear do they receive? And there are ways to study this. And I, you know, I'm not a veterinarian, and I would trust the veterinarians to get into this. And in fact, they do get into that. Veterinarians, societies establish different standards for different animals, precisely on the bases that I described. So I think that is important. But what is remarkable here, and I think this brings up the issue of human exceptionalism again, is there's really an effort to And it's an emotional effort across a broad array to try to prove that human beings are not different or have higher value than animals. This altruism example is a classic. But human beings are the only species we know of that are moral agents. No animal is a moral agent. No animal can be held to duties. And for me, it seems that that being a rights-bearing creature has a flip side of the same coin, and that is you're also a duty-bearing creature. So human beings, inherent in our natures, are moral beings. We are moral agents. And unless we are either immature or ill or injured in some way, we develop a moral capacity. No other animal does so in the same way as human beings.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. Wesley, it's been a very, very interesting hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Wesley Smith, and the book is A Rat is a Pig is a Dog is a Boy, The Human Cost of the Animal Rights Movement. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production. Tomorrow, a great lineup. Jim Lehrer and Richard Clark will be joining us the first hour of the program. Anna Quinlan, the second hour of our Wednesday show, so please stay tuned, everybody. You can check us out on Facebook, too, and that's The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead.